You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, kōjou tōku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in studio today by producer Evie. Coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kemp, I spoke to her about Winston Peters meeting with his US counterpart Marco Rubio, the recent IPSOS issues monitor survey findings, and the recent developments in Israel's war on Gaza. I spoke to a political marketing expert from the University of Auckland, Edward Elder, about the most recent IPSOS issues monitor survey, which recorded the government as having the lowest score since the survey started collecting data in mid-2017. And global innovator Matt Hart joins us in studio today to discuss the new TV series Adolescence and how this relates to creativity and innovation. Evie, what do you have for us today?
For our weekly catch-up, I spoke to the ACT Party's Simon Court about the ACT Party entering candidates into local elections, ACT MP Mark Cameron criticising Nationals' approach to rural communities, as well as David Seymour failing to inform the Education Minister that a key school lunch provider was going into liquidation. I also spoke to geopolitical analyst at the University of Otago, Jeffrey Miller, about Foreign Affairs Minister Winston Peters' recent trip to the US and what outcomes this achieved for US-New Zealand relations.
He aho whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wai mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e ware ware e a hei ana koto te whakarongo ki e nei, kōrero ano hei pakihiri rokiroki mā runga, i te pai tukutuku o Irangi Pōho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly chat with Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kemp.
Recently, Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Affairs Minister Winston Peters met with his US counterpart, the Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Despite this meeting, not much is known about the details of what was discussed. However, the two did discuss tariffs, which Aotearoa may be affected by unless the country is exempt from the current upcoming agricultural tariffs. For our weekly catch-up with Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kemp, I spoke to her about Peters and Rubio's meeting and what the party thinks of this meeting between the two politicians. We also spoke about the most recent IPSOS issues monitor survey and Israel's recent aggression against Gaza. Last week, Foreign Minister Winston Peters met with his US counterpart, the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio. To start, how important does the party believe our diplomatic relations are with the US?
Well, the Peters-Rubio, you know, situation, it shouldn't come as a surprise that the Deputy Prime Minister has met with Trump's inner circle, Marco Rubio. Peters has launched an outright attack in a State of the Nation speech yesterday, attacking wokeism, which apparently includes those who are pro-equity, pro-diversity and pro-inclusion. These are Trump tactics that we need to be careful with and monitor the Deputy Prime Minister closely.
Despite discussing tariffs, Peters has not opened up much about this area of discussion. However, he did say he was leaving the US more confident than when he arrived. However, whether New Zealand will be exempt from the agricultural tariffs the US are set to impose on international exports in early April is still unclear. As the US has moved to our second largest export market, how is the party feeling that the potential tariffs we may face are still up in the air?
Well, on the tariffs, there is no way Deputy Prime Minister Peters will be successful in getting New Zealand excluded from these. Trump has been heinous on their closest neighbour in Canada, and Australia have been unsuccessful in seeking such exclusions.
Winston Peters says he was seriously pleased with the outcome of the meeting between the two. How are the party feeling about this sort of statement from Peters?
Well, like we've said, we've got to watch and continue to watch the Deputy Prime Minister and what he's doing and who he's, rubbing shoulders with. It's something that we need to keep a closer eye on.
Moving on to our second topic, the latest IPSOS Issues Monitor survey, which surveys government favourability, has shown that those a part of the survey gave the government a 4.2 out of 10, the lowest score ever recorded since the survey started collecting data in mid-2017. Does this surprise you?
Yeah, this is also unsurprising that New Zealanders are finally seeing the impact of irrational evidence lacking policy from this government. So it's not surprising at all that this is what the public are seeing. You know, while I was on recess, I went to meet with the Salvation Army in Manurewa and met with their, what they call their CHIOP groups. So there were four groups. Actually, they've got six groups, but there were four groups meeting that day. And they're, you know, community people who come together to, one, purchase cheaper kai. They also make their own, produce their own marakais in their own backyards. And they talk about sharing and the knowledge that they have as a group. And, you know, our communities are in dire straits. Our communities are, you know, they, like we talked about poverty. We talked about why this group was important for them to keep connected. A lot of them were women and older women, like grandmothers, who had lost connection to others and didn't feel comfortable going out. And I think the biggest thing for whānau at the moment is accessible kai that is affordable for them to feed their families.
The findings from the report show a mostly downward trend since around May 2020. Is this a problem this current government is facing, or do you believe the previous government was slightly missing the mark as well?
Look, you've got to take into account what the last government did as well, but this government says that they're turning it back and bringing it back, and their motto is this is about growth and growing Aotearoa, but with growth still comes loss and poverty at the bottom of the scale. I mean, two weeks ago, the government, you know, made the decision to remove the living wage, and we've had people comment and contact us to say how they can't afford to live without their living wage. Again, they'll be struggling.
You've kind of touched on this previously, but respondents of the report indicated that Te Pāti Māori were the best party to manage issues facing Māori. However, for the top issue respondents recorded, which is inflation and the cost of living crisis, data shows that respondents believe the National Party is the best party to manage this. How would Te Pāti Māori plan to tackle inflation and the cost of living crisis that National isn't?
Look, we haven't seen the cost of living improve at all. And Te Pāti Māori has a tax policy that looks at ensuring those at the bottom of the tax bracket receive more, and that we tax the wealthy. And we can't get around not doing that. I mean, our people are struggling. 400,000 people on welfare, it's the highest since 1998.
For our final topic, we have recently seen a new wave of aggression from Israel against the besieged Gaza Strip. These recent strikes have now resulted in over 50,000 Palestinians being killed since October 7, 2023. How is the party feeling about these new developments?
Yeah, well, this follows a more than two-week-long blockade by Israel on the entry of all goods and aid into Gaza. Israel deliberately targeted densely populated areas, schools, homes, shelters for displaced people in the middle of the ceasefire. This was a clearly premeditated act of terrorism on people who are trying to piece their shattered lives back together during ceasefire. Israel has no intention of honouring the ceasefire. If they were capable of honouring, we would not be in this situation to begin with. And in fact, it's really hard to watch and see, you know, as a person, to watch and see the death toll, the loss of lives across this. It's getting sad. People have to step in. Countries have to do more to help.
Green Party co-leader Close Warbrick has called for cross-party support for her members' bill, the Unlawful Occupation of Palestine Sanctions Bill, which Te Pāti Māori supports. The bill only needs six MPs from National ACT or NZ First to support the bill to pass it. How is Te Pāti Māori planning on helping to get this bill through?
Look, Te Pāti Māori will support Chloe and the Greens and her members' bill and ensure that our votes are there. We definitely want to support her bill. And I think it's about more advocating on all of our behalf to be able to encourage those in other parties to vote.
That was Te Pāti Māori's Takarai Kemp on Winston Peters and Marco Rubio's meeting, the recent IPSOS Issues Monitor Survey, and Israel's recent aggression against Gaza.
That was our weekly chat with Te Pāti Māori's Takarai Kemp.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Last week, the ACT Party announced that they were going to stand candidates in local elections for the first time. The party is calling for a clean-out of councils, slating them for failing to make change. The claims have been met with backlash from councillors who say David Seymour and the party don't understand the work that goes into local government. For our weekly catch-up, I spoke to the ACT Party's Simon Court about what decisions led to the move and what the party hopes to achieve in local government. We also discussed ACT MP Mark Cameron, who made headlines last week for saying National was leaving farmers and rural communities worse off than James Shaw did due to their higher emission reduction promises. And finally, we discussed David Seymour failing to inform Education Minister Erica Stanford that a key school lunch provider was going into liquidation. But I started off by asking ACT about entering the ring of local government. For the first time, the ACT Party has announced that it's going to stand candidates in the local elections this year. Can you explain a little bit what led to this decision-making?
Well, Kiwis voted for real change in 2023, but our councils, well, some of them at least, seem to have missed the memo that it's time for a clean-out and a change in direction. We feel that ratepayers are fed up with councillors who make big promises to get elected, then whack up the rates. You know, they're not fixing the roads and pipes that they're elected to fix, and continue to waste money on pet projects. That's why, you know, ACT is fighting for real change in government. We'd like to be able to contribute to local government as well, supporting councillors to do the same. Lower rates, scrap those nice-to-haves, end this anti-car ideology, and take race-based decision-making out of local politics.
Yeah, the ACT Party has been talking about this kind of clear out of local government, but they've also been criticised as being too harsh by actual councillors themselves and not understanding the work that councillors put in. What does the party have to say about that?
Well, I've worked for Auckland Council for 3 years, and I had an opportunity to work with some really, really good people on different projects. The challenges with elected members, with councillors who don't understand their role, don't understand good governance, aren't asking good questions and holding officials to account, that's where the failing is. So while I understand that, you know, a lot of work goes on in the engine room of councils, which is where I worked as an engineer, what we're talking about is fixing the governance. Auckland Council is a $3.5 billion a year organisation. We want to make sure that when it comes to these big entities spending ratepayers' money and, you know, responsible for actually seeing our cities develop properly and that we get, you know, the best outcomes for people, that we have good governance. And that's what ACT is focused on.
Having a turnaround of councils and driving more change and productivity like you talk about, it all sounds quite idealistic. How do you actually intend to get this change moving?
Well, it is idealistic. It would be ideal if councils were focused on making sure that they delivered infrastructure in a timely fashion. And, you know, just take Auckland again, Watercare, their water CEO announced late last year, that they were going to stop receiving development applications from large parts of Auckland where they'd run out of capacity in the wastewater system. Now, their sole job is to deliver wastewater capacity so that houses and businesses can be developed. Auckland Council owns the CCO. We're really concerned that in the absence of adequate governance, basic things like making sure that there's pipes to connect to when thousands and thousands of homes need to be built over the next 5 or 6 years, that stuff should be delivered. So when we're talking about idealism, most Kiwis would just take it for granted that councils do that stuff, but you know, it has become idealistic to imagine. We want to turn that around. We want good candidates to put their hands up to come to ACT. I understand there's been hundreds of registrations of interest, and you know, we'll be interested in talking to those people about, you know, how they see things and what we can potentially do to change some local government, which currently is not focused on the right things.
Let's move on to our next topic. ACT Party MP Mark Cameron made headlines last week for accusing National as being worse for farmers and out of touch with rural communities. Is this an attitude supported by the ACT Party?
Well, if you listen to what Mark actually said in context, he was merely reflecting feedback he's received from fellow farmers on the ground at the Northland ANP show and other events that he's attended or hosted. So I think, in fairness to Mark, he wasn't accusing our other governing coalition party of anything. He was simply saying, this is what I'm hearing, and hearing from people who might also be open to supporting National. But I think what he's reflecting is that the government has committed to a Paris climate target that is essentially no different, in fact, slightly more onerous than what James Shaw, as the Green Climate Minister, committed New Zealand to back at the Glasgow COP conference. And a lot of New Zealanders, including farmers, don't understand why New Zealand has such a tough target. There's a lot of other countries in the world, like Russia, like China and India, you know, trading partners of ours, are paying lip service to it and then ignoring it. And of course, you know, the largest economy in the world and one of our largest trading partners, the US, has said that they're no longer intent to participate in it, in the Paris Climate Agreement, because it doesn't meet their economic, strategic or security objectives. So I think Mark was certainly reflecting back what he had heard. And I think it's entirely valid that as we look to the next stage of the Paris climate commitments New Zealand has made, yeah, are they affordable? You know, can we hope to achieve them? Are we going to end up in a situation at some point in the future where we have to say, well, we've spent billions and billions and billions of dollars and all we've done is sterilise large parts of the productive economy and yet we're still building a million-tonne coal stockpile, you know, this year to keep the lights on in New Zealand?
Do you think your party striking out against its coalition partners is beneficial for the government?
Well, that's certainly not how I would characterise Mark's comments. I think Mark's role as, you know, a farmer MP and chair of the Primary Production Select Committee is to make sure that what he is hearing from constituents is fed back to government, and he's doing a very, very effective job on that.
Let's move on to our final topic. Also in the headlines last week, it was revealed that David Seymour didn't inform Education Minister Erica Stanford where he'd found out school lunch provider Labelle was going into liquidation, and instead she only found out through media reports. Do you know what drove this decision-making?
Well, as a responsible minister, David Seymour's duty is to make sure the program delivers. And updating other ministers on a minute-by-minute and hour-by-hour developments in the portfolios sounds ideal, but I think they'd rather he fix the problems and deal with them. And in this instance, David's office did make sure that the Prime Minister and his office was kept informed of developments, which is entirely appropriate.
But it's not just a small development, it's a huge development in the program, and there was 5 days between David Seymour finding out and Labelle officially being placed into liquidation.
So I just want to reiterate that David Seymour's role as a responsible minister is to make sure that the service continues and that the contractor, the main contractor, is held to account. What their relationship with the subcontractor means, and, you know, making sure that the food is delivered on time and to the quality standard, they are all challenges that that no doubt the minister was managing. But keeping other people informed, you know, on a minute-by-minute, hour-by-hour basis, or even day-to-day, is not necessarily what ministers typically do. You know, there are 30 ministers, there are over 80 portfolios, Many of us, you know, I work in the infrastructure and resource management space. We often find out about things through the media, and that's simply because there is so much information, there is so much happening at any given time, can't all be expected to update everybody who we think might need to know. Yeah, the last thing we want to do is end up sending out CC all emails about the latest thing that we've just heard from one of our suppliers or one of our agencies. That's just not how government works. It's frankly not how any organisation works.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Corr on the party standing in local government elections, ACT MP Mark Cameron criticising National's approach to rural communities, as well as David Seymour failing to inform the Education Minister that a key school lunch provider was going into liquidation. We'll be right back. Text in 5395 on any of your thoughts on these pieces.
That was Simon Corr from the ACT Party.
Hey, is all the same. Excuse me while I die inside, but it's okay.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
Last week, Foreign Minister Winston Peters made a trip over to the US to meet with the new Trump administration. On the trip, Peters carried out a number of meetings with officials such as US Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Peters has since revealed very little about what was discussed or achieved in these meetings, instead simply stating he was very pleased and more confident going out than coming in. The main questions around the trip were what effect Trump's tariffs may have on Aotearoa, as well as what trade with the US will look like moving forward. However, little has been revealed following the trip. I spoke to geopolitical analyst at the University of Otago, Jeffrey Miller, about this trip and what Aotearoa can expect to come out of it. Winston Peters travelled to the US last week to meet with various officials, including US Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Going into this trip, what did it seem like the main objectives were for Peters?
I think there are a couple of objectives here. One of them really was working out what the
US position on tariffs is with regards to New Zealand. Donald Trump has promised or pledged to introduce tariffs on all agricultural imports from April the 2nd, which is next week. So I think Winston Peters really wanted to find out, is that still going ahead, and can there be some kind of exemption or carve-out for New Zealand? In other words, he was there to plead New Zealand's case. Beyond that, though, I think these meetings that he had, he also had a meeting with Mike Waltz, the National Security Advisor, as well as the one with Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State. I think the meetings were very much focused on defence. And that certainly came through in the brief summaries that were being given by both sides, by both Winston Peters, the New Zealand Foreign Minister, and Marco Rubio, the US Secretary of State. They've focused quite heavily on defence. And Marco Rubio's statement was quite interesting because he said that they discussed defence cooperation and burden sharing. Burden sharing can be interpreted really as New Zealand spending more money on defence, and that's certainly going to happen. New Zealand is waiting for a defence capability plan that should be issued before the budget, so sometime in the next 6 weeks or so, we should get hold of that, and that will probably show New Zealand is going to be spending significantly more on defence, and that will be good news for Marco Rubio. I think it would have been pleasing to hear that. It's just to what extent that it all helps New Zealand's case when it comes to trade. Is there some kind of quid pro quo when it comes to the tariffs? The fact that New Zealand is going to be spending more on defence, does that count in New Zealand's favour in any way? Or is it seen as a completely separate issue by the US side?
So coming off the back of this trip, much of what was actually discussed has been kept kind of under wraps by Peters. Is this common practice when meeting with foreign leaders?
Yes, unfortunately, we tend to just get bland descriptions. Winston Peters said that it was substantive and productive, which can mean anything. He said that he was seriously pleased with the meeting and came out more confident from the meeting than he was when he went in. I guess you could interpret that in different ways. You can say, well, maybe that means good news on the tariff front. I would say probably not necessarily. I think in large part, this meeting was probably about discussing the future of New Zealand's involvement in AUKUS. There's been a lot of talk over the last couple of years whether New Zealand will become part of Pillar 2 of AUKUS, which is at the moment a three-way pact involving Australia, the United States and the United Kingdom, and is very focused on building submarines, nuclear-powered submarines for Australia. And Pillar 2 is about expanding that grouping to a wider group of countries that could include potentially New Zealand, and to focus on advanced technologies, AI, quantum computing and so forth. Winston Peters is very, very keen on this. He's very, very keen on getting New Zealand closer with the United States, and he wants this still to happen. But Donald Trump's election did put that into some question, or call that into question, because of Trump's views, which are quite different to the previous Biden administration when it comes to New Zealand governments, and you're seeing this with the tariff issue. So it seemed like all but a certainty in a way with the Joe Biden administration, and if Kamala Harris had been elected president. Since Donald Trump's come in, there's been a question mark over AUKUS, and I think Winston Peters' visit was really to talk all about that, and we haven't seen that mentioned in any of the statements. We haven't seen the word AUKUS used, but I think that's probably what was being discussed. And I don't know, Winston Peters is quite a skillful politician. I think he knows how Donald Trump operates. He was foreign minister the last time around, and I wouldn't be surprised if he proposed some kind of grand deal to Marco Rubio, for example, a trade and defence arrangement with the United States, perhaps New Zealand joining AUKUS Pillar 2, but getting a free trade agreement with the United States in return. I don't know whether the United States would entertain this, but Donald Trump is known, of course, for considering big deals and innovative deals, as he would see them, creative arrangements. Potentially there is some room there. And Winston Peters, I think, no doubt would have talked up his New Zealand First credentials. He gave a speech yesterday aimed at a domestic audience in New Zealand where he talked about making New Zealand first again. And he has a habit of separating these two roles, both New Zealand First Party leader and foreign minister. But I think he's also quite skillful that he could easily combine those, and when he's talking to US officials, to really emphasise the fact that he's, you know, New Zealand First Party leader, that he believes in nationalist policies, that he's leading a war on woke, as he sees it in New Zealand. That was the phrase he used yesterday at that speech in Christchurch. So I think he may have tied all these things together, but we're not going to know exactly what was discussed in the end. We're left to read the tea leaves and interpret these quite anodyne statements.
Yeah, I did want to touch on some of his language used in his State of the Nation speech yesterday. Much of it has been labelled as Trump-like and with an anti-globalist sort of rhetoric. Do you think Peter's own personal populist attitudes could possibly put New Zealand's interests at risk when negotiating with the US?
Well, I think Winston Peters would see it as actually helping New Zealand's interests by putting New Zealand on the same page as the Trump administration. And he is an unusual minister, Winston Peters, and he's an unusual minister in the government. The fact that New Zealand has a foreign minister from the party called New Zealand First is perhaps to New Zealand's advantage. He's quite a chameleon, Winston Peters, and under the Biden administration, he was presenting himself perhaps more of an establishment figure. Someone who was very interested in New Zealand-US ties and recalling history and so forth. He was dealing with a Democrat administration last year. But this year he can sort of take that persona away, and he can replace that with his New Zealand First persona that he uses domestically. So in a way they are converging. Now your New Zealand First persona that's aimed at getting re-elected in New Zealand, that's focused on all kinds of cultural war issues, if you like, economic nationalism to some extent, but really culture war issues is where I think Winston Peters sees as the main fertile hunting ground when it comes to getting votes in 2026. But he's able to use that in a way with his foreign policy mission, at least to the United States. It wouldn't go down very well probably in other contexts. I mean, it just depends which country you're visiting, whether and which minister you're talking to. But he's quite skillful, Winston Peters, in that he can really change his persona depending on who he is talking to. And he's got a grab bag of views that can be used for any particular occasion. And he can show you the kind of view that you kind of would like to hear in many ways.
Obviously, the main concerns when it comes to the US and foreign policy are trade agreements and tariffs. And like you said, there's been little clarification on how New Zealand is going to be affected by these. But what do you think New Zealand could expect from foreign trade going forward?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. What will exactly happen? I mean, New Zealand has quite a low tariff regime. And that was something that Winston Peters, I think, was keen to point out to Marco Rubio in his conversations last week, was that New Zealand's very open to US trade. We don't have very high tariffs. They're around 1.5% to US products coming into New Zealand on average, whereas New Zealand goods going to the US face a tariff of about 3.5% on average. But yes, look, the trade side is it could be very damaging to New Zealand. The United States is New Zealand's second biggest trading partner, and New Zealand has 28 billion New Zealand dollars in two-way trade with the United States, $16 billion in exports, $12 billion in imports. And that $4 billion differential is actually it's a good news for New Zealand in many ways, because it's a trade surplus. It's in New Zealand's favour. But when you're dealing with the Trump administration, they look down at the countries that have trade surpluses with the United States, because in the US view, that means that country is taking advantage of the United States. The US wants to be the one that has the trade surplus, not the. It doesn't want the other country having that. So that's a weak point, perhaps, in New Zealand's arguments to the United States. I think Winston Peters was very much pointing out, well, we're very open to US trade. Our tariffs are very low, but there are some products where New Zealand does have tariffs on US goods, particularly vehicles and machinery. There are still some significant tariffs out there, air conditioners, things that we don't perhaps think about to a degree. But New Zealand makes some money there out of the tariff regime. And New Zealand may have to reconsider that and abolish perhaps the last remaining tariffs with the United States. The problem there is that you're going to have to then reduce the tariffs for other countries. That's the way it works in international trade under World Trade Organization rules. So it will cost some money for Nicola Willis that she doesn't really have
at the moment as finance minister. But I think all of these things will be on the table, and if Donald Trump is all about the art of the deal, I think Winston Peters would be very keen to cut a deal with the United States, and one that's going to help New Zealand exporters, because when it comes down to it, New Zealand sells $2.6 billion worth of meat to the United States every year, $1 billion worth of dairy products. It's no small change, actually, and if tariffs do come in that are harmful to New Zealand exporters, it really could make quite a difference to New Zealand's economic prospects, and that's something that New Zealand First, Winston Peters and the government really just can't afford. With the good economic news that came out on Friday about New Zealand's economy growing again, they desperately don't want that going back into reverse, certainly not ahead of election year in 2026.
That was geopolitical analyst at the University of Otago, Jeffrey Miller, on Foreign Secretary Winston Peters' trip to the US. We'll be right back. You're listening to 95BFM.
Give the environment a big green thumbs up this March and April during EcoFest. EcoFest is hitting the city once again to provide a whole month of incredible events to spark sustainability. From arts to gardening, transport to repairs, and food to woodworking, there is something for everyone. EcoFest, on now till April 22nd. Discover what's on at ecofest.org.nz. And then I thought a paperless office wasn't eco-conscious enough, and I heard about this thing called greenwashing. So, ta-da! Take a look at your new desk. I made everything green.
Oh, that's not...
It's The Green Desk, every Wednesday on The Wire, brought to you by EcoFest 2025.
Put on your classiest double denim. We're going to San Ray for breakfast. And lunch. Might stay for a late afternoon snack. And we wouldn't want to miss out on the dinner menu. Or a late night treat.
San Ray and Ponsonby. Perfect for lingering or for a quick stop to recharge. With all-day coffee and cocktails and a delicious menu influenced by links to Mexico and California. San Ray. Open 7 days, 118 Ponsonby Road.
Check out the coolest exhibition at New Zealand Maritime Museum. Hui te Ananui a Tangaroa. Into ocean and ice. Go on a polar journey to Antarctica and experience five artists' interpretations of the fragile beauty of this epic landscape. From Ernest Shackleton's heroic expeditions to the climate-threatened island of South Georgia. Into ocean and ice. On now until August 31st, 2025. Free entry with museum admission. For more info, go to maritimemuseum.co.nz.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Sheba.
What if you call it?
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
The original originator.
95.
You can listen to us while you're at home doing some chores, or you can take us along for company while you're driving and you're in a car.
Go to 95BFM.com for show podcasts.
How big is his hole? And do...
That is not in the public interest, I can assure you.
The Wire.
As briefly touched on earlier, the most recent data from the IPSOS Issues Monitor Survey was released. The survey looks at various factors, including government favourability, as well as what areas in Aotearoa are of the most concern for respondents. The survey recorded data from just over 1,000 individuals and shows that respondents gave the government a 4.2 out of 10, the lowest score the survey has recorded since collecting data in mid-2017. I spoke to a political marketing expert from the University of Auckland, Edward Elder, about these findings. I started off by asking him if these recent statistics are a surprise to him.
No, I guess not. It's sort of a case of multiple things happening at once, as you could say. The main one being that, for one, with anything like inflation or the cost of living, you know, inflation may reduce, but prices don't. So that in itself can cause issues, especially when we still have things like, you know, interest rates where they are, for example. The other sort of broader issue to keep in mind when it comes to these kinds of surveys with a relatively new government is we're sort of hitting that period where the government is moving away from being a new government to being seen as the responsible government. And what that really happens there is it goes away from the hypotheticals of opposition, so to speak, where the promises made at the election time are sort of seen as aspirational to, okay, is the rubber hitting the road, so to speak? The realities of government, where all of a sudden they are seen as responsible for, you know, the problems people are facing in their lives.
Yeah, that is kind of a common trend we see with this study, with the survey. And although the survey only had just over 1,000 respondents, do you think the survey is sort of indicative of how the rest of the country is feeling?
I mean, I think so. Based on what we can see, for example, in polling across multiple, you know, companies, for example, we are seeing sort of a downward trend in the government perception, partly probably because of these same issues. It's not a case of, I guess you could say, losing to Labour, shall we say, on issues like the economy or the cost of living, but just the gap between the two reducing over time, for example, and the importance of those issues actually reducing over time as well. So you can actually see that even though, for example, the cost of living is still the number one issue, it's not as high up as it was, say, a year ago, where I think it was at about 60%-ish in the Ipsos poll from last year at this time, about February, and it's down to 50% now, so in terms of its importance. So that's one thing. But then again, also that sort of the gap between Labour and National on those issues has reduced from, I think, at the peak about a year ago, 10% to just down to 4%. So just things like that, as we're seeing sort of across polling across, and that can come from the National. So it's not just National in this case, it's the government. So there is also, that could also play a role in terms of the other issues that we're seeing in the last few, about early March. So I'd have to go back and look at exactly what the issues were at that particular time. But, you know, we're looking at things like the school lunch program, for example, as an issue, sort of issue that has popped up in the relatively recent past that might have played a role in something like this.
In the previous, in the same survey, data from October 2024 shows that this number was at 4.7 out of 10 before dropping in this most recent period. What may have contributed to this drop in this most recent period?
Again, I think it's probably more than anything else, it's just a broader case of that transition as the government sort of transitions away from the responsible government, the one that is actually seen as responsible for sort of issues that people are attributed to the government more broadly. So that's sort of, I'd say, the main one. I think the other factor, again, coming back to my point, that we're seeing between the coalition partners as well, again, looking at the school lunch program as an example of this, the impact this could potentially have on the Prime Minister, for example, the image of the Prime Minister and the impact that has on the government. If the Prime Minister is seen as not dealing well with their coalition partners, for example, that can have an impact. So, you know, this is more recent, but the, you know, the international trip to India, for example, has been seen as a relatively successful trip. But that was obviously after this poll was taken, for example. That is where it intends to sort of excel, is in those sort of that role as the diplomat, right? Because of his previous sort of work experience, if you will. When it comes in government, for example, maybe that's not as much as strength because he is actually relatively inexperienced in the role. So that can sort of maybe play a part in it. But I think, again, going back to the original point, I think it's a broader case of that the government is now being seen as actually responsible for the you know, the country more so than have been in previous poll.
The ratings in the survey have relatively been decreasing since its all-time high of 7.6 in May 2020. There have been a few points where there may have been a small increase or statistics have stayed relatively the same, but overall findings have been decreasing. Do you believe these rankings sort of align with what we're seeing internationally as well, such as the implications of global conflicts, the COVID pandemic, and political tensions?
Yes, I think it plays, you know, being overseas, I think you look for Australia on, well, until recently, I would have said Canada, United States, Britain. You're basically seeing, because of these issues, like the cost of living, you're seeing governments being, you know, a lot of the incumbents who were in government during COVID-19, for example, being voted out, for example. The other issue well is just that, you know, for a good chunk of the voting public now, things like rising cost of the, you know, inflation and high interest rates have never been a something that they've had to deal with. I, for example, sort of came into adulthood around the time of the Great Recession, and I'm now almost 40. You know, someone like me who grew up in a post-recession or became an adult post-recession period has never had to deal with the sort of high interest rates of someone who might have, you know, or in high inflation, that's who, you know, grew up or was sort of an adult in the 80s and 90s would have had to, or early 90s would have to deal with. But I sort of moved to a group of people in society and sort of seeing this now, we're seeing internationally how this is playing out in the we just it's being sort of voted out or even voted in and then potentially being voted out if you look at somewhere like Australia. So there is something that we are seeing internationally in the sort of, you know, the Five Eyes nations, shall we say.
The top concern people have as a part of the survey is inflation and the cost of living crisis. Respondents still believe the National Party is the best party to combat this, although the percentage of those who believe this have dropped to 32% from 35% in October. Do you believe we could see another party take the lead heading forward?
Potentially, it really depends on, say, the two major parties still dominate the sort of media conversation, especially between elections. The election period, we see minor parties get a bit more attention. So if it was going to be a party, obviously it would be the Labor Party. They are still the closest by, you know, I think they're 4 points behind National at the moment. It would depend on what the Labor Party proposed in order to sort of deal with the cost of living. And, if, you know, that was seen as sort of like a viable alternative. Again, part of this in the inverse of what National is facing is that Labor will eventually, the stench, if you will, of their previous, you know, period in government will have sort of evaporated, so to speak, and they won't have the same level of be seen as responsible for any sort of issues that people have, you know, again, going back to things like the cost of living. So that would play a role. It would, but again, it would depend on, I think, in Labor's case, on a proactive in what they were promising in order to deal with, for example, the cost of living. And or if it was something that the public saw as viable, or as was seen in the last election, was something like the removing GST off fruit and vegetables, where that didn't land and actually became something they were trying to not talk about by the time, you know, not long after they announced it, rather than something that was seen as sort of like a net positive, shall we say. So it would be something like that, but again, in the case of something that would actually be seen as a viable alternative.
We have recently seen the economy slightly move out of a recession, with Stats NZ data showing our GDP has increased by 0.7%. As the cost of living crisis and inflation are respondents' biggest concern, if our GDP were to increase more, do you believe we could see stronger support for this government as a part of the survey?
The economy generally, I think, was something that was rising in terms of its salience or what people saw as important, only just, I think it was only like 2% or something like that, and has sort of hovered around that late 20s for a while. Yes, but although when the economy, there is always a lag period between the actual, you know, changes in the indicators and how people are actually feeling. So it's sort of one of those, it's interesting, almost intangible as well, because people might feel, you know, or they might be employed themselves, but hearing, you know, things like low with rising unemployment, for example, is one of those things where people go, oh, things are bad. And so it can take time because it's sort of quasi-intangible, more so than something like the cost of living, which is a lot more acute. The economy is sort of a broader issue area, shall we say. It can take quite a while for those positive trends, again, they're very to sort of to the sort of public consciousness. So if it were to be something that would be a net positive for the government, whether it would be happen before the next election, I think it would be a close call, but I think it's the election's only a year and a half away or something like that, so it might, I wouldn't bet one way or the other, but that way.
And what could we expect from the next survey period? Do you believe it may increase or decrease even further?
I won't give it a specific number, I'd say slightly up, but not as high as October 24. Let me put it that way. Somewhere within that 4.2 to 4.7 band. Again, there might be sort of a small, you know, jump just based on the idea that things are slightly improving and people will become slightly more, say, adjusted to the you know, prices as they are now, and interest rates will probably continue to decline over a period of time as those become more tangible to people, when people actually know, go to refix their mortgage or whatever. So that may play a role there, but I don't think we're going to see some sort of massive jump in government performance over the next 6 months. The other thing that we might want to keep in mind, and this is more political, the political side of it, is the coalition partners. Again, I mentioned the coalition partners and Luxon maybe not always being seen as best dealing with that, his coalition partners. They themselves, for their own branding reason, could potentially start to, let's say, distance themselves from the National Party. Maybe not in the next, how long is it, 4 or 5 months? Something like that, 3 months. But in the next, between now and the next election, you may see the two minor parties start to distance themselves, become more independent, push back on the National Party on certain. And that if there is that sort of internal squabble, I mean, Winston Peters was involved with it, right, going right back to like 1998. You may see that play a role in potentially hurting the government before the next election. That's not the next period, but that's the next year and a half. Just because, again, that when a government is seen as if there's a lot of infighting, that can have a really, you know, negative impact on their public perception. But whether that will happen between now and, say, well, let's say June, whenever the next survey is done, I don't know.
That was a political marketing expert from the University of Auckland, Edward Elder, about the recent IPSOS issues monitor survey data.
The Wire.
Now we're joined in the studio by Matt Hart, Global Innovator. How are you doing this week?
Good, thanks, John Levy. Kia ora to you too. How are you both?
We're doing good today.
Great.
I just saw a button just
fall. You're just fixing
a
button?
Yep, that's kind of scary to look
good.
At. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, very, very good.
Don't
very
touch
good.
It.
All right, yeah, so we were just briefly talking about our topic just earlier.
Well, I just thought in terms of, you know, if innovation often is trying to capture the global zeitgeist or the local zeitgeist at any one time, I suggested to you previously, but I said to you both, being cultural curators yourselves and working in media, surely you're across adolescence at the moment and have watched it.
I know, we have.
Spoilers, we're not.
We have not been watching Adolescence. What is Adolescence?
So Adolescence is a Netflix show that just dropped, I think, 10 days ago, something, don't hold me to it, last week, end of last week, but one. And it is a four-part series, 1 hour each show. So it's they call it a short-form series, don't they? And it is an incredible show in the way both it's, we should talk about how it's shot and made,
yeah.
But also its subject and what it's talking about. It's a drama, and it's talking about toxic masculinity, the family issues around that, the social, broader social issues around that, incel culture. And I don't think it's giving it away because you find out very early on. It's a young boy, 13-year-old boy, who is accused of murdering a young girl in class. And it focuses on the school. It focuses on the detectives, trying to investigate, and then the parents and the community around that. That split into four series, and then they break it up in terms of the establishing the story, showing the parental story that goes on. They then do a whole show of the therapist and understanding what may have caused this. And then there's a wash-up I won't tell you about on the last show.
Oh, interesting.
It is super interesting.
Yeah, even I was just both talking about it with our friend Sophia, and she's also like a massive, massive fan. And those topics seem like quite intense, really. And, you know, how does the show go about it?
Well, it tells it from a first-person immersive experience, because the most innovative... So you can talk about the content and the story and the narrative, but the way they've shot it draws you and puts you at the heart of the story, because each show is shot in one continuous take.
Yeah.
There's no editing. And it's as interesting to think about why they... To go into the backstory, why did they shoot it that way? To hold that intensity of the narrative, to show the spontaneous reactions without cutting away. How many times it took them to do that. And what it means is you as the viewer, it is... Like, I binged it. I watched all four at once, started at about 7, ended up at 11:30, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And it's as much a viewing show as it is a visceral experience to be there. And you journey with whoever you buddy up with, this kind of the character in the story, who you go with. But for me as a parent, it's really hard-hitting. So I would really recommend it for any parent, for anyone who has younger siblings, for anyone who's interested in these cultural messages and themes that are now really being surfaced in terms of screen time, in terms of kids in their rooms on their own, what are they doing and gaming, and how who are they being connected with. We've talked in our little slot a lot about how you like something on a social post, the algorithm grabs you, it starts taking you down this journey. Mm-hmm. They speak to all of those themes. They talk. It raises the idea of feminism and how we still need to be solving that. But has that and does that mean we've left behind the idea of young boys, what it means to be a man and a male in today's culture, and how do we nurture strong, resilient men in the context of you know, gender identity, gender fluidity, men's roles in society?
Yeah, because I feel like with young boys particularly, we've seen quite a strong push to them going to the far right, like falling down that pipeline.
Yes.
Like, I remember, not that I went down that myself, but I have some male friends in high school who started listening to political commentators who are definitely far right, like not just right wing, they're quite far right.
Quite extreme.
And they fall down this pipeline, like you said before, they're liking posts, engaging with certain content, falling down that algorithm. How much is that kind of talked about?
It is talked about, but you're viewing the experience of it. So they're not having a social discourse because it's all anchored around that event and what's happened in that event, and then why did it happen and who's responsible for it, who's guilty, etc. But the parents, they're reflecting on their experience of that. I won't give too much of the show away, but they're reflecting on their experience of parenting, and of course the guilt and the reflection of, is this really our child, our young son? And there's an older sister who represents the other side in the family context as well. I think for me, when you start to read the global discourse that's bubbling up, and you can read it everywhere if you just type in adolescence and see what's been said, there seems to be obviously that instant reaction. How do we stop boys doing that? And what's not perhaps been more deeply discussed or understood is, well, let's get beneath the hood of that. And what is it that young boys, young men particularly, are missing out on? What aren't we giving them? Why are those people like Andrew Tate, etc., the hard right messages, why are they so attractive? And how do young boys who seemingly are well-adjusted, coming through their teens, etc., going on this quite quick path from being, let's say, in that language, Joel, centre, to then suddenly ending up in hard right, you know, discourse.
Because it's interesting, you're watching this from a parent's perspective. Do you think, as a parent, you kind of understand the sort of push that young boys particularly are going through? Do you think a lot of parents know what's going on social media and how the algorithm works?
I would say no, in general. I'd say for the, let's say, the mass market parent or whatever, we're all doing the best we can. But, you know, in today's world, it seems to be that if our kids are fighting for something, we want to give it to them, we want to help them have these things. But outsourcing that really boundaried parental role to a screen or a game or a social media algorithm and having no oversight of that, I think it provides the space for that sort of algorithm to grab those kids and take them into places that you as a parent would not want them to end up. Of course, what happens is when they end up there, it seems so hard to get them back.
Yeah, and for young people like ourselves, what do you think we may learn from watching this TV program?
Well, I think you, in terms of the cultural curators, etc., you're interested in the role of masculinity in culture, you're interested in the role of femininity in culture, you're interested in gender fluidity, people identifying themselves. We talk a lot about trying to know who you are, your story, how that manifests in the world. It speaks to all of that. Because it's that old thing about it takes a community. You know, it's not just on these silo nodes of parenting to bring up that kid, given there's so many other touch points that can influence those kids, especially their peer groups, especially the schools. I think you would be interested, as broadly from more that cultural perspective, but also reflecting on your own experience of your parents and what they raised you with.
Yeah, because, I mean, obviously, Evie and I are from the generation where we grew up with social media, which is obviously different than like a lot of older generations. So when you're raising kids, I'd assume it's quite a new thing to get used to, and you would be kind of concerned about what your children might be doing online.
100%. It must be hard to navigate when it's something that you don't understand fully yourself as well.
Correct.
And is this kind of like a conversation you think should be opened up with more parents?
I definitely
and people
think
in
it
your generation?
Exactly. I think it starts to surface and go, well, how are we parenting? And I think at the broad view, how much screen time are we not across that these kids are having, and what's happening in that content? But my question for you guys and sort of your generation is, do you feel you've developed, given you've grown up with screens and social media, the sort of critical inquiry skills to look at a piece of content and assess for yourself, do I agree with it? Do I not agree with it? Do I want to comment on it? I mean, how have you developed that confidence?
I think so.
I think so over time, but it's definitely a lot of trial and error. And I think even when Joel and I would have gotten social media, what, like 10 years ago now, things have changed so much since then as well.
Yeah.
So I can't really imagine what it's like for kids now.
Well, would you agree it's become, like, it's really polarizing, right?
Yeah.
In
yeah.
terms of the discourse and social content, like X now stands for some kind of thing.
Yes.
You know, Insta and this idea, you know, that, and then there's TikTok, etc.
Yeah, I feel like there are certain social media platforms that align with certain political ideas, like Trump. Donald Trump has his own social media platform. Truth Social.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, the first sort of social media platform I got heavily invested in was Vine back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just short form fun content. I was, you know, 12. It was just kind of like funny videos. I was watching some anime stuff on there. Like, it wasn't anything too serious. But now it's like, oh, like, here's, let's talk about some far right ideology, blah, 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 blah. Not necessarily aimed at kids. That age, but more so finding its way
finding
to kids that age.
That's
it's
the thing.
Still accessible.
Yeah, it finds its way there, and I think what we're not doing, I guess this gets to the rub of it, for me, the takeout, if you get really under the hood, that real need for critical inquiry as the world, we've been talking about AI, fake news, a young person to look at a piece of content and try and develop the skills to assess it for themselves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is it true, is it not? Do I agree, do I not? Do I ignore it, etc.?
Yeah.
That, you know, that and everything that surrounds that is the real need here.
Hell yeah. 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 Awesome. Well, I think that's all the time we have today,
well,
Matt.
Well, listen, I encourage you guys to watch it, and perhaps we can pick up and do a part two on this next week and see your thoughts.
We'll do our homework.
Definitely.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome.
Thank
all right.
You
thank
so
you, Matt,
much.
So much.
Okay.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te ho taka koto katoa mo tene wiki. Nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kemp, the ACT Party's Simon Court, the University of Otago's Jeffrey Miller, the University of Auckland's Edward Elder, and global innovator Matt Hart. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.